Okay. I guess I don't know where I should start.
From the beginning.
Off. Thank
start
you.
Beginning.
It's hard to repeat something with spontaneity when you just said it, but I will do it again. Okay? Okay. So all mute your phone, because I did that. Maybe the mass mute, maybe that's what it meant. So I was explaining that today is the Yerbav Titi Mahotsava, the disappearance day of Shri Prabhupada. And although I'm going to have to do something and tell me if it affects the call. One second. Rati, can I be heard? Rati, can I be heard?
I can hear you, Maharaj.
Okay, thank you. So I was saying that it's the disappearance of Prabhupada, although it's the Yoga Sutras, I will just say something about maybe what I'm going to speak about. And yesterday evening, we had a primer to today. We have our Sangha. And in that Sangha, we discussed many subjects. We read from the Sarathi Darshini commentary of the maybe 15th chapter of the 10th canto. We read CC, we had Kirtan. At the end, Vaisheshika Prabhu, who is the facilitator of that Sangha, he asked different devotees to he asked everyone just to say in a sentence or two some appreciation of Prabhupada. And Jayadvaita Maharaj just gave a quote from Prabhupada. Prabhupada said, "I hate bureaucracy because the business of bureaucracy is to say no." And that inspired me to speak something today about Prabhupada and how reluctant he was to say no, and how he empowered so many young people. Dependency of any social contract, especially institutions, is to say no. And that's usually the first interaction of your contact with them. And Lucky, can I be heard? I keep on getting messages that I'm coming in and out. Hare Krishna? Lucky?
I can hear you fine, Marsh.
Okay. Okay. So that's the tendency of institutions, and that the first response is no, or what you can't do, or the negative aspect. And Prabhupada was the opposite. Prabhupada was always giving fresh challenges, not only telling you what you cannot do, but telling you what you can do that you didn't even perhaps realize you could do. And that's the history of the Krishna consciousness movement spreading. You know, how he, even Jayadvaita Maharaj himself, he didn't say, oh, you never graduated from high school, or maybe he did graduate from high school, but not much more than that. You know, or what can you do? He made him his editor and said, whatever you edit, it improved and it encouraged him. And Lord John Prabhu and his wife going to China when they were 20 years old. Of course, sometimes Prabhupada said, well, you know, maybe I was too encouraging, like he said with Sanyati, but the principle is there. Just like he gave Guru Kripa and Yasodhanandana Sanyas when they were 21. And they went to South India to defeat all the opposing philosophies. And they went into the Paja Goswami, which is the Madhvacharya. You know, they're only chosen by astrological, you know, some great soul, and they're so strict and learned. And Yasodhanandana Swami, I believe in his French-Canadian accent, challenged him. What are the three aspects of the absolute truth? Anyway, the point is, it's so nice to remember Prabhupada and Prabhupada being empowering. And I think I'm going to speak about that. I also mentioned, as you said, I was coming in and out. Nothing I can do about that. What I have my email on, and I can get messages if that happens, is that some, you know, senior devotees will congregate here. More and more so, the people who stay in Govardhan don't go to Vrindavan. They like to come here. And we'll have Gopi Pranadana Prabhu, Jayadvaita Swami, Keshav Bharti, Vaisheshya Prabhu, Prabhupada Punachand Prabhu, who's preaching in Moscow. And it's usually in Vrindavan, there's usually so many speakers, they have this 5 minute limit. But here, devotees can really open their hearts. So I'm looking forward to that. The other thing I was going to speak about is the late Priyad Bhagavat Amrita. Try to give a vision, and maybe someday a person will write this. Narada Muni searching for the topmost devotee. You know, the story of Priya Bhagavat Amrita. But what, you know, his reaction and what he could walk into, how enlivened he is. Imagine Narada Muni flying into New York and to see Prabhupada because someone told him Prabhupada was the greatest devotee. How enthusiastic he would be if he's seeing the scene of Prabhupada in Tompkins Square Park, you know, surrounded by Western people, you know, giving the message of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So I'm really looking forward to the day. I also mentioned that I might have to end a little bit earlier today, but it'd be a nice meditation for everybody in the Sangha. Maybe you can share it at the end. One of your favorite, of course, you may not be Prabhupada's disciple, you may not have seen it personally, but perhaps one of your favorite scenes that you would think would be very enlivening for Narada Muni to see. I remember in Yadavar's film, that scene of Prabhupada, they had a life-size in this hall, a life-size Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and Prabhupada had all the devotees circling in the kirtans. One of the first times I saw Prabhupada was in Golden Gate Park. The first time I saw it, I think it was 1970, from the few times that I forgot what year that was, 1972. And the Prabhupada got off the Rocker Yard card, 10,000, 20,000 people in the park, and Prabhupada gets up and dances with that wonderful kirtan. And so it's a nice day to remember Prabhupada. Now, a little something about the Yoga Sutras. This chapter is about the practice, and it recommends Kriya Yoga, which has three parts: simple austerity, tapa, svadhyaya, the studying of shastra and the chanting of. As the study of shastra, and the chanting of mantras, and Ishvara Pranidhan, which is working in the world in a spirit of dedication to God. And this is necessary to actually get you to the platform of meditative absorption or yoga. Because that takes a yoga really takes, when they speak yoga, they don't just mean hatha yoga, the exercise. They talk really about the meditational, so you can actually control your mind. That requires sattva or goodness. And that's a very, very high qualification. When you read the Yoga Sutras, you see, I'm also thinking about Prabhupada, how he actually gave us the process to get to yoga in terms of a higher meditation. It's getting very practical by giving us activities where we can work in the spirit of devotion. And those are activities that are free from karma. Because karma is caused when activities are done with the consciousness of identifying the mind as the self. And the mind is a repository of food and desire. So, working in a spirit of devotion, you're not working in terms of thinking yourself the mind, but you're thinking yourself the soul, the servant of Krishna. And that's the whole essence of Bhagavad Gita. It's even in a war, and I hope no one takes up jihad from misinterpreting this out of context. But any activity in the Bhagavad Gita is a war. When that activity can be done in a mood of service, like a policeman who may use weapons to protect the innocent and is not doing it out of a sense of smitta or egoism, then there's no reaction. Anyway, these three things, and he describes that the result of these is that it will bring you eventually to the platform of samadhi, which is the perfectional state of yoga. And it will destroy the kleshas, which means you're suffering. And destroying suffering means destroying the cause of suffering. And the cause of suffering is different subtle mental conceptions that bring you into the bodily concept of life. And the bodily concept of life means that the soul, which is pure and eternal, misidentifies itself with the body and mind, which is impure and temporal. So there were five different core mental states, called avidya or ignorance, asmita or egoism, raga or attachment, dvesha or aversion, And the last one is called clinging to life or fear of death. So these core concepts, they bind one to the body and therefore the cause of suffering. And in this, it also shows the relationship with these conceptions and karma, because that's actually the root of karma. When you're in this bodily concept of life, and you're acting in the bodily concept of life, which means you're acting as the body or enjoyer, then you you receive reactions to your activities that are meant to detach you from the activities and the conceptions, the material conceptions that cause those activities. And in that little discussion of karma, it describes that if you don't become free from the kleshas, the cause of identification of the body and the cause of suffering, then the karmic cycle continues. And it's a very tragic thing, almost, the karmic, because you're walking around within the subtle body with this unlimited storehouse of reactions to your past activities that have that were not able to manifest in the body. The body in this life, it's kind of limited, and only a certain portion of your past karma can be funneled into this life. Which part? That's inconceivably decided by God. So in the next life, at the end of your life, there's something that rises from the sanchitta, the unmanifest karma that becomes prominent due to many reasons. And due to that, the nature of your birth is determined. The nature of your lifespan is determined. And the nature of your experiences, good and bad, are determined. And it's kind of set into motion. And even if you take to the yogic process, which disconnects you from the connection to the body, like a fan which you, whose plug has been pulled out, it still kind of continues a little bit. The fan's going fast, and it goes less fast, you pull it out, but still, initially it's still spinning. So, when you describe it, those experiences are your pleasures and your pains. And then the section we're up now, and this is finishing this section on kleshas, that he lets it know that for the yogi, for one who has discrimination, who understands the difference between the soul and body, and understands that this connection and the activities and moods that cause this connection are the root of suffering, that yogi who is sensitive, like an eyeball is sensitive even to a hair, he understands that all is suffering in this world. And he gives four reasons, you know, how all pleasure is suffering, because the result of pleasure is suffering. It's the result of pleasure is an intensification in the bodily concept of life. Therefore, sexual indulgence, which may be on temporarily the highest type of pleasure, leads to the greatest distress because it absorbs the Purusha or the self in the body, and therefore one experiences the body and its suffering to a greater degree. And as said by Vidyan Bhikshu, a small amount of suffering is felt more than an abundance of pleasure. So the result of pleasure is pain, and the yogi knows that. The yogi knows that. And he knows that the pleasure is pain itself, because the pain is the fire of desire, which only increases by indulging in material pleasure. The desires only increase if they're not done in a regulated way or with some kind of plan. So this is the problem. Person of the script, he understands and how he finds, and then ultimately it's frustrated, and when it's temporary, and therefore there is duality, that the things that give you pleasure will give you equal amounts of pain, because if you're attached to something that you will lose, the enjoyment that you get from it will be the source of an equal amount of, or of equal amount or more of pain. So this is for the yogi. You know, that even though you can get good karma, that's also not wanted in that sense. Or one wants to also be free from that. And we shouldn't have that aspiration either. And we see that good karma, high birth, opposite sex, more money, and even more pious types of karma, they have their downside. Which is such an important point, that happiness is not a stimulation of the senses, but it's the development of a higher mode of mind. And the stimulation of the senses, although pleasurable, might not lead to a higher motive mind. It may lead to a lower motive mind. So that may be the same thing that gives you pleasure, may be the source of your depression. That was really one powerful realization that helped me come to Krishna consciousness personally. I just somehow was blessed. As soon as I came to Krishna consciousness, to understand that sinful life would, that sinful life substantially and seriously risks the development of a happy state, and risks putting the mind into lower modes of unhappiness, even depression. Krishna immediately, I'm so humbled in one sense, but it's a fact, he immediately gave me that realization fact and demonstrated it to me immediately. So, and now, He makes the point today's very suffering that is yet to manifest is to be avoided, and how the yogi can see that, because even though it doesn't exist, you can avoid it. And it gives a simple example that the suffering that you're now experiencing is caused by your past action. And if you understood that in the past, you could have avoided what you are going through now. And whatever you're going through now, it could be avoided. It could be avoided. It could have been avoided. The cause could have been avoided. So in that way, you should think that what you're doing now will cause future suffering, or understand what the things that you, what things you do now that cause future suffering, and you should avoid them. But if you want to completely avoid suffering, then you have to extract the soul from matter. And as, again, a small amount of suffering is felt more than abundance of pleasure, the abundance of pleasure that we seek, which causes an abundance of suffering, is not worth it. And especially for one who's spiritually evolved and coming to the platform of yoga. You should have this vision. Now, the next verse is the... Now it starts a whole new section, and this section is, okay, it describes suffering. It describes the cause of suffering. Basically, that's what we've been discussing. And now we're going to start to get in how to end suffering by removing the cause of suffering. So the next verse describes the basic cause of suffering. The conjunction between the seer and that which is seen is the cause of suffering to be avoided. So this connection, the seer refers to the soul, and what is to be seen in this case refers to the buddhi. Intelligence. Now, remember, in this school of psychological thought, the buddhi is, it's through the buddhi that the soul experiences the world. The world, anything that comes through the senses, makes an impression in the buddhi. It's like a film. You know, light comes through the film, and according to the nature of the film, that's what's perceived. And the light of the soul comes through the buddhi. Now remember, in the Sankhya, computer-based Sankhya, it's a little bit different. That's called the chitta. Here, the chitta is the combination of the mind, the body, and the soul. Here, the chitta, this is a little bit separate, but either way it refers to the same thing. That somehow or other, there's an element of the mind that's close to the soul, and through that conjunction, that identification, the soul experiences. Now, Mahamuni brought up some of the problems we have of taking experience away from the soul. I don't even know what it means. For example, here it says, experience of pain is just experience of buddhi, not of anything actually transpiring in the purusha itself. But due to ignorance, one thinks that the purusha is in pain. My question is, who thinks, if not the soul? One thinks that the purusha is in pain. Well, who thinks? It's the purusha itself. So it's hard for me to say how the purusha is not experiencing pain. And if it's not the purusha that's experiencing pain, then what difference does it make? Because I'm the purusha. So I'm not experiencing, he's telling me I'm not experiencing pain. What's experiencing pain? Matter itself cannot experience pain. So But I guess it's a concept of identification, just like someone who's poor in India, it used to be like that, but they ride their broken down bicycles with their Fitbits and they go to the movies, and they watch the movies, and it's a sense of identification. It's not them, but when they see a superhero, they identify with the superhero who breaks up the plot to destroy the government. They're not a hero, but they think they're a hero. So it's something like that, that the soul thinks he's the mind and the body. But there must be a spiritual mind to think that you're the mind and the body. And therefore you suffer by this identification. And also from a technical standpoint, even when the soul identifies with the mind, if the mind's in its natural, undisturbed state of suttva, one will feel peaceful. So it is the mind influence, and it's so important for us to understand. It's the mind influenced by passion that causes us pain. Because passion, the experience that our well-being, peace, and happiness is a result of moderation, says Harinamananda. It's result, and when Rajas activates and one becomes overactive, overindulgent, hyper-energetic, one's peace of mind is destroyed and is replaced by suffering, either mental in the form, say, of acceptance, anxiety, and craving, or physical, the form of ulcers, and indigestion, sexual disease, etc. So it's, but the suffering is not located in the purusha, it's located in the buddhi, the mind. Really, it's something really to meditate on, because we know we're going to die. And generally, we can look forward in the future to this painful, excruciating experience. But it's somewhere confident to know that it's not inherent or constitutional in us, and therefore can be transcended by spiritual awareness. So that's kind of enlivening for us. In other words, the ever-changing states of the buddhi do not change the consciousness, even though there's a conjunction between them. So the wise, Vyasa says, works to rid themselves of this identification with pain caused by conjunction with the good. And therefore, we can see same person, same experience, same thing happens to them, a different experience of it due to their mind and or their transcendence of the mind. Their transcendence. That's why tapasya, living simply, is so important. And not, excuse me, one second. That's why living simple is so important. And to perform some austerity. Which means doing our duties despite the irrational impulse of the mind and senses, because austerity allows us to abstract ourselves from the mind and body. And if we're always just accommodating our whims and constantly trying, like America, it's hot, AC, it's cold, heat, turn up the heat, shower, hot water, do everything we can to avoid any discomfort. We're We have to be, you know, when we live a simple life, we accept a certain amount of discomfort, not artificially, but in terms of our service to God and our duties. That difficulty helps us to extract the mind from the body. Our identification with the mind and body, which is just a mental conception. That's why people in undeveloped countries sometimes who don't have a harsh life but have a simple life have a much higher happiness index because they've extracted themselves more from the mind and body by the nature of their living in the culture. Would anyone like to perhaps remember a instance of Prabhupada's activities that would have been enlivening for Narada Muni to see? Okay, you can just all think of that, but it would be nice if someone could just say hello.
Well, Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Oh.
Who's that?
This is Shyamarupa.
Oh, Shyamarupa. Hey, thanks for coming.
Oh, Hare Krishna. Ah. I'm not there, but I am there. Govardhan with you.
I know. Boy, this year, Shyamarupa, it would have been even more ecstatic for you. I mean, the quality of the guitar, 4 hours a day. So anyone who's staying here, and kind of intimate. Wow, thanks for coming on. Thank you.
Hare Krishna.
Hey. Hi, Bo. Anybody else like to say hello? Anybody else?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Henry, great. Thank you. Thank you. Great. Wonderful.
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj.
You good?
Jai Nitai here with the rest of the family.
Oh, greetings from Govardhan.
Thank you.
That's great.
Oh. Maybe not.
Okay, what do we do?
He's expressing ecstatic symptoms, though.
I know his ecstatic symptoms. I know. Wow. Great, I don't know, it's really nice. I'm thinking of Prabhupada. Yeah, I'll try to relate, I guess, on the front of I'll take notes of the kind of the celebration here is nice because it's kind of intimate and it's generally on time and you know, we generally finish up by 12:30. We have the feast before 1, then we can rest a little bit and meet again in the evening and share realization. It's nice. Thank you all. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Bol Maharaj, it's TJ and Melinda.
Wow, so nice to hear from you. Great. Thank you. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Remembering that wonderful parikram we had it kind of was mystical where we went to Imlital and Radha Damodar. Yesterday, Shraddha Devi, she's never been to Govardhan. She's from Philadelphia. She came to my Vyas Puja. So she was just here with the Guru Maharaj, Rupindra Sri Prabhu, for a short time, never seen. So basically, he had a short time, and she called me up, and I said, come on out to Govardhan. And she came with someone else. And I just took her to Govindapur. And basically, all we did there is chant. And it was really amazing, too, because somehow all the really deeply mystical people I know in Govardhan just immediately came, including this one boy, 12 years old, that was so, and they would say too, so beautiful that looked more like Krishna than anyone I've ever seen. And he was very peaceful, which is unusual for the people in Anayur, that little village. And then I just met so many just wonderful, deep people came over. Gauji, which means Balaram, this man who herds the cows by Govindapur. And whenever I see him, I give him 100 rupees, which for him is like winning the lottery. And it was, but he takes care of the cows at Govindapur, so that's good. And then I saw this Brahmin from town who, his family tradition for hundreds of years is to cook 50 to 100 sadis. You know, some rotis or chapatis and a little something else. And they just come and get one chapati. He always invites me. I know his house is in the village. Come to my house. I went there once. And then I went into this old ashram, kind of a little bit off the way, but in, it's so mystical. It's where it's a tradition of real mystics, you know, people who would meditate, and there's a famous one, Manohar Baba. And I like going there because they have all the pictures, these black and white pictures of these spiritual all-stars of Govindapur. And it was so funny, and I walk in, and there's about five or six sadhus and one married man. And they were sitting around, like talking, sitting on the floor of the temple room, kind of. And I wanted to darshan of the deities. And I thought they were studying Shastra. And immediately when I came in with them, the man who was talking stood up and immediately came over to us. And he was a person from Calcutta and spoke in English. And very charmingly and humbly, he explained to us about his guru and the significance of the place. And then offered us prasadam. And then I said, what were you doing, studying Shastra? He said, no, here's our yearly meeting. So I got to see the GDC meeting. What I was impressed of is no amount of management can surpass the principles of Vaishnavism. The fact that a guest came in, everything stopped, you know, in a very practical, you know, humble way. And we were just charmed by the whole thing. And took that prasadam, and then we went to this little Jagannath temple. I wrote about it once, where when Hari Kirtan, I give them a donation to them, which should have been the end of the world, and then Hari Kirtan was going to reach into his wallet, you know, his money belt, and I said, no need, because I gave him so much. Sorry, don't mind, I don't want the money. He said, but remember the story of Shankaracharya, of Bali Maharaj, when his guru, his guru's name is, I'm going to remember it. I'm just going to take a deep breath and remember his guru's name was Shukracharya. When he stopped him from giving, when he advised him not to give any land to Brahmanadev, then he was cursed and rejected. So when I met the sadhu there at the Jagannath Mandir, you know, he was so nice. He sat down and I said, hey, you remember me that story? And then he went and he got us this delicious prasad that they cooked for the deities, just a little bit, of a chidwa. He said, we cooked it here. So it was just nice, mystical, being with the Saudis. Okay, I'm going to go to the do my deity worship, and I pray you can all come back and come out here and visit me in my place at Govardhan. It's just simple and just beautiful and a wonderful facility, spiritual life. And the nice thing is there's five similar places that my friend owns. So there's a good chance if anybody wanted to visit me and stay out here, they could stay out for a few days. And I don't need a kitchen. I do have a kitchen because the prasadam at the Bhaktivedanta Ashram is superb. It's the spiritual life. Okay. Thank you all. Great to hear from all of you. Vanchakopatridya shakatasindhi devija pratipanam bhagavan.